It's hard to remember now, but the internet used to be fun.
I can't believe how easy it is to surf the net.
Surf's up.
On Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet, we'll trace how a tool that once fueled democracy...
Opposition activists organized the march on Facebook.
...became a weapon aimed at the very heart of it.
You're watching the unraveling of our democracy right now.
From Longlead and PRX, this is Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Last night's earthquake off the Russian coast happened in a dynamic place for seismic activity.
The enormous Pacific plate, the seafloor of most of the entire Pacific Ocean, is pushing up against the edge of Eurasia there. What happens is they get stuck.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, tectonic collisions 101 and an eyewitness in Japan. Also in the Mediterranean, raging wildfires are a sign of the times.
Forest fires at the moment are about 30 times more frequent and more intense.
Skin lightening creams are popular in Africa and beyond.
People feel that when they are lighter, they are more attractive.
But researchers are finding links from those creams to cancer.
And why hackers are going after hospitals.
That's all ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for coming along this Wednesday. We begin today in Russia's Far East, where an earthquake of historic magnitude shook earth and ocean in the pre-dawn hours.
Near the epicenter of the quake, tourists on a boat in the Sea of Okhotsk felt the movement. In a video posted to Telegram, the tour operator, Alexander Bogoslavsky, described what they saw next. A very strong rockfall began, he said. At first, we did not understand. It was as if some kind of veil of mud began to fall from the top of the island. They realized it was an earthquake when a bunch of sea lions started diving into the water to escape falling rocks.
It has turned out to be one of the biggest earthquakes in recorded history. For perspective, the strongest earthquake on record was a 9.5 on the Richter scale. That was in Chile in 1960. The 2011 earthquake that crippled the Fukushima power plant in Japan was a 9.0. Last night's earthquake was an 8.8. Harold Tobin directs the Pacific Northwest Seismology Network at the University of Washington. He told me today that the earthquake happened in what's called a subduction zone, where one tectonic plate slides under another.
In this case, it's the Pacific plate sliding under the most far eastern part of Russia, the Kamchatka Peninsula. And it's sliding underneath it, but they stick together at the contact point between the two of them. You know, kind of imagine one of those moving walkways disappearing underneath the end of the walkway. Well,
right.
What happens is they get stuck. That's what a fault is. It builds up the stress and it builds up the strain on that fault until one day it gives way. And the plates move slowly. It's a few inches per year that they're moving on a steady rate. But at the edge where they're stuck together like that, it goes all at once. And in this case, slip of, 10, 20, 30 feet, probably more than that, actually, between the two plates. And that's the earthquake itself.
So this quake happened in eastern Russia. It's a place called the Kuril-Kamchatka subduction zone. It happens to be, as I read, one of the most seismically active zones on the planet. So why is that? What are the conditions that make it that way?
Yeah, the main condition is simply that the Pacific plate is moving relatively fast relative to that part of Russia. It's about 8 centimeters per year. That's twice as fast as, for example, our Cascadia subduction zone here on the west coast of the U.S. Mm. So it accumulates the strain just, 2 times faster. There actually was a magnitude 9.0 earthquake in virtually the same spot in the year 1952 that also sent a tsunami across the Pacific Ocean.
Right. So as long as we're talking about tsunamis there, just remind us exactly how earthquakes cause tsunamis.
Yeah, the tsunami is really caused by a movement, a displacement of the seabed, of the bottom of the ocean. When the earthquake happens, that makes the seafloor lurch out towards the Pacific by maybe 30 feet or more. And during that moment of lurching forward, it's literally lifting the seabed up. If the bottom of the ocean moves up, then the water above it also moves up. Water doesn't make hills. So instead, it starts, a wave moving away from that area.
So not long after the initial quake, Hawaii started sending out evacuation orders. Just a few hours ago, Chile sent out a tsunami alert. I mean, Chile is really far away from Russia, the southern tip of South America. Russia obviously is way up in the northern hemisphere. How does an earthquake in Russia potentially cause tsunamis as far south as Chile?
Yeah, it is amazing, isn't it, to think about? I mean, the Pacific Ocean is a just enormous part of our planet, more than a quarter of the planet's surface. So once a wave gets going in the ocean, of course, normal waves kind of dissipate over long distances, but tsunami waves are extremely long wavelength, meaning sort of the wave might only have a hump, a height of a meter or two, but the wavelength can be, you know, hundreds of kilometers or hundreds of miles even. The tsunami waves travel across the ocean at roughly the same speed as you can fly in a, you know, in a commercial jet. So it took many hours to get to Hawaii, several more hours to get to the West Coast here, and now finally to even the Southern Hemisphere and the coast of Chile.
So obviously we've seen another major earthquake. There are aftershocks, and sometimes those aftershocks are stronger than the original quake. Can you detect whether this fault line is still kind of unsettled?
Well, certainly, yes. There have been many aftershocks. We've already had a 6.9 and quite a few ones smaller than that. And we expect the aftershocks to continue for some time after an earthquake of this size. In fact, weeks to months to even years. But with a, you know, tapering off, diminishing frequency.
There was an earthquake recently that was detected in Alaska. Is that connected in a way to this one? Was it maybe a harbinger?
No, it's not connected in the sense that those distances along the Pacific Rim are far enough that we don't think that stress transfers in some way from one part of the one subduction zone to another. So that earthquake in Alaska was along the Alaska-Aleutian subduction zone. On the other hand, the area where this 8.8 occurred 9 days ago, there was a magnitude 7.4. And there have been a number of other ones that now we can see are foreshocks to this event. So foreshocks are tricky. You'd think we could predict earthquakes from foreshocks. The problem is, we never know they're foreshocks till a bigger one actually happens. And a magnitude 7.4 is not that unusual an event. But it's really clear that it was a sign that the fault system was moving towards this much larger earthquake.
So the tsunami warnings in Japan, which was right in the path of potentially huge waves, those have been withdrawn, though the warnings were a reminder of Japan's vulnerability. What will you be watching for next?
Yeah, we know that a number of locations around the Pacific Rim have the hazard of a very large earthquake like this, striking with a tsunami and really, you know, without short-term warning. We know where the sort of danger zones are, but we don't know when they're going to occur. The places that are most on our mind from the point of view of a Pacific tsunami now are the region of Japan to the southwest. So in 2011, northern Japan had its magnitude 9 earthquake. There's a possibility of a similar one off of the southwestern coast of Japan, a place called the Nankai Trough. That would be a devastating event, and they're watching closely for that in Japan. The second thing that's always on my mind is the Pacific Northwest, where I live. The Cascadia subduction zone is basically a mirror image across the Pacific of what we just saw in Kamchatka. We know we have a hazard that could really happen any time, and by any time I mean from today till 100 years or more from now, of a giant Cascadia earthquake with a devastating tsunami. That's very real, and we have to be prepared for it in the USA and in Canada as well.
Harold Tobin is an expert in earthquakes and tsunamis at the University of Washington. Stay with us this hour. We'll speak with a university student who lives on Japan's Pacific coast about how her day went under a tsunami warning. That's later in the program.
Cyber criminals have a new favorite target, hospitals. In the past few years, cyber attacks on healthcare systems in Europe have surged, especially ransomware attacks, where the hackers demand that hospitals pay to get back into their own systems. Part of the problem is outdated technology. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry explains, private healthcare providers here in the U.S. might be making things worse elsewhere.
Last June, media outlets broke the news that Britain's National Health Service had been hit by a cyber attack.
And we start with breaking news this hour. A number of procedures have been cancelled or redirected to other NHS providers following a cyber attack on some of London's major hospitals.
The attackers, who turned out to be from a Russian ransomware gang, had hacked a company called Synovus that provides blood testing services to some of London's top hospitals. In the next few days, hundreds of cancer treatments were postponed and more than 1,000 operations cancelled. John Jorsted, who lives in Hertfordshire, found out about the hack when he got a phone call from London's Royal Brompton Hospital. His son Dylan was undergoing treatment there.
We were literally called the day before his surgery and told that his surgery was cancelled.
Dylan, who's 15, was set to have a major operation that week. A few months earlier, he'd been diagnosed with an aggressive form of bone cancer.
They wanted to take anything that the tumour had been pressed up against when it was the full sort of size of 16 centimetres or whatever it was originally. So it was obviously a very serious surgery.
The operation was postponed. The hack meant that Synovus couldn't share information matching blood supplies to patients like Dylan who were undergoing surgery. The hackers reportedly demanded a ransom of $50 million.
Criminals are looking for organisations with data, money and vulnerability and pressure. And healthcare is a good place from their point of view to find that.
Kieran Martin is the founder of the UK's National Cybersecurity Centre. He says healthcare is one of the most vulnerable sectors, not just because it's often chronically underfunded, but because a hack can actually lead to patient deaths. For hospital staff, being constantly on alert for cyber attacks can also be a bit of a drag. Sabina Magalini is a former professor of surgery at a hospital in Rome.
You go crazy because sometimes, especially if you work in an emergency department, you can log in and log out of the system 80 times a day, every time with username and password. It's really very, very time consuming.
Magalini recently coordinated an EU-funded project aimed at improving hospital cybersecurity. Facial recognition would be really beneficial, she says, for some hospital staff. But like everything, that costs money. 4 years ago, Ireland's National Health Service was hit by a massive cyber attack. It caused a temporary shutdown of all its IT systems and cost the state around $120 million. The Irish government estimates it will cost a further $770 million to really safeguard the sector from future hacks. Magalini says that should have been a lesson for every other European country.
Healthcare is underpaid in every member state of the European Union. And so apparently they're taking it seriously. But in practice, if you don't make the investments, it's very difficult to upgrade the system in a stable way.
Kieran Martin, the cybersecurity expert, says antiquated IT systems in some of Europe's hospitals aren't helping either. There's literally nothing you can do if computer systems are too old, he says. Private healthcare providers in the US may unwittingly be making matters worse for Europe's public hospitals because they're under no obligation from the state to refuse to pay a ransom.
They just have to get their healthcare system back up and running, and so they're often incentivized to pay. But what does that do strategically? It means they come back for more and more money out of healthcare everywhere in the developed world.
Right now, Martin says, no threat worries cybersecurity experts more than attacks on healthcare. Dad John Jorsted in Hertfordshire in England says he doesn't hold a grudge against the hospital or the NHS. His son Dylan had his operation 1 month later and is now on the mend. But Jorsted says,
my real frustration and anger is that there's literally people in the world who will, attack the most vulnerable to extort money, basically.
The hackers later dumped 400 gigabytes of patient data online. Dylan's records are probably out there, Jorsted says. But right now, all that matters is making sure his son gets through this. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
German sports fans had been hoping for better news. An Olympic athlete from Germany was injured yesterday in a climbing accident in Pakistan. Today, Laura Dahlmeier was confirmed dead. She was hit by falling rock during a remote climbing expedition. It happened on Layla Peak in northwest Pakistan at an altitude of nearly 19,000 feet.
Dahlmeier won a gold medal in biathlon for Germany. Germany's president remembered her today as a role model for peaceful, cheerful coexistence. Dahlmeier's body has not been removed from the mountain due to bad weather. A family statement said it had been Dahlmeier's expressed wish that no one risk their life to recover her body. She was 31. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Geometric patterns on cloth, symbols etched into sacred masks, an ancient writing system. These are artifacts from Zambia that tell a history of a matriarchal culture. The objects are housed at the National Museum of World Cultures in Sweden. When Samba Yanga visited the museum several years ago, she was surprised to learn about them. Yanga is the co-founder of the Virtual Women's History Museum of Zambia, and she's familiar with the historical people who used the artifacts.
The communities lived very close to the earth and had knowledge and information about cosmology, their environment, and the community. And they understood that you had to be in communication with these elements in order to have continuity of life.
Officials at the Stockholm Museum were eager for help in better understanding the objects. The result is an online collection that explains their significance. Samba Yanga spoke with me recently about the project, and in particular an ancient writing system that was used by women and etched into some of the objects. Here's Yanga.
In a lot of these communities, they were matrilineal, which means women were at the center of the communities. There were female kings, there were female leaders of communities, nation builders, custodians of the land, custodians of the food as well.
I'd love to have you describe some of the artifacts that we're talking about here. The hunter's toolbox, we have an image of that on our website. It's so intricate looking.
Yes, the hunter's box was used when one of the elders or the community members or hunters would go hunting. And those symbols would be evoked before the hunter went hunting in order to protect them, in order for them to understand the process they'd have to go through. Earlier, I mentioned that there was a very close connection with the environment, mm-hmm. and they understood that the trees, the animals were all part of the cycle of life, and they had to give respect and honor to the animals, to the trees, even if that's where they got their source of food from. So that was a practice that was very embedded in the communities, and it was something that had to be practiced every single time a hunter went to hunt for food.
I'm speaking with Samba Yanga about a lost language used by women in Zambia that was written onto artifacts that have been housed in a museum in Sweden, which now gets us to the question, Samba, of how these items and photographs that are included in this collection ended up in Sweden in the first place. How did they get there?
That's one of the things that surprised me, because when you think of Sweden and Scandinavia, you don't think of them as colonizers because they officially never colonized any country in Africa.
Right.
So when I got there and I was with the African curator, Michael Barrett, he then said to me, oh, you're Zambian. You know, you should probably come and see the Zambian collection. And I asked him, why do you have Zambian collection? Because in my mind, it never connected that Sweden would ever have a collection. UK, that makes sense. France, it makes sense. Belgium, it makes sense. Not Sweden. And he was like, actually, what used to happen in those days is the Swedish and Scandinavians would book space in British voyages, ships going to the continent, because they couldn't afford ships themselves. And that's how they ended up on the continent. So I was like, oh, okay, we didn't know that. So that's how these particular artifacts that we examined, like the cloak, like some of the Makishi masks, ended up in the museum.
Samba, I wonder if this has been emotional work for you.
Since we started the journey, it has been emotional, because we've been having these conversations around how, as Africans or how, as Zambians, we've had to shape shift without even realizing that that's what you're doing. And the memory is not that far off. In order for my father to access education, he had to shape shift and conform to a Eurocentric model of education, religion, and living in order to be allowed into a school system, in order for him to get an education so that he can earn a livelihood. And that process actually resulted into a shape-shifting and a duality that a lot of Zambians and Africans still live, where you're crossing in and out of this identity. So part of the work that we are doing is trying to connect those two parts and trying to center our own indigenous knowledge so it doesn't feel like we have to discard it or shape-shift in order to conform.
So this language...
And that has been very emotional.
Yeah. Mm. So this language that you have helped to document and decipher and teach people about is an example of something that might have been forgotten because of forces, making people adopt a more Western language learning style in order to advance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The intention was to control, to obscure, remove, and dominate. And the hegemony of this domination has continued on without an effort to restructure and reposition. And I think we have the responsibility to do that now, especially understanding what's at stake for even the generations to come.
Samba Yanga is co-founder of the Women's History Museum of Zambia, a virtual museum. Many of the objects in Sweden will eventually be brought back to Africa. In the meantime, Yanga and her team will continue to study and decipher these artifacts. We have photos of some of them at theworld.org.
It's a concert venue so famous that it's name-checked in the greatest rock album, in my humble opinion, of all time.
Count them all. Now they know how many holes it takes to fill the album.
The Beatles and their surreal lyrics about holes in the Royal Albert Hall in London. Well, the prestigious venue is at the center of a case headed to court. Three private seat holders sued the Royal Albert Hall last year, claiming they'd been unlawfully excluded from performances in the venue and therefore deprived of their rights.
People have owned seats in the historic venue since the late 19th century when those seats were sold to pay for its construction. Today, about a quarter of the seats in the house are still privately owned. Members get free tickets to most events, which they can use or resell.
But there is a catch. In 1966, the Royal Albert Hall Act allowed the venue to exclude members from exactly one-third of its performances. The members who are suing say the hall excluded them over that limit, and they are demanding compensation, as well as an injunction on the Royal Albert Hall to prevent it from breaking the rule in the future.
The judge denied both requests and ruled that the case should go to trial. In the meantime, there's no shortage of recordings from the Albert Hall for the rest of us to enjoy. Dua Lipa, for example, performing Dance the Night at her Albert Hall concert last fall.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Returning to the day's top story now, the earthquake that hit Russia's coast in the early morning hours, setting in motion a cascade of events that literally shook the world.
The earthquake triggered tsunami warnings in far-flung locations, from Hawaii all the way south to Chile. In Japan, the sound of howling emergency sirens brought back memories of the quake and deadly tsunami that pummeled the islands in 2011. That's a childhood memory for Moe Miyake, a 22-year-old student at Keio University. She's in the school's Emergency and Information Studies program. She lives with her parents in Chigasaki, a coastal town south of Tokyo.
So the alarm first went off on my phone at around 9 a.m. I was already awake then, but I wasn't watching the news or anything, so I didn't know anything about the earthquake that happened in Russia. And so the alarm did startle me at first because that was the way I found out about the tsunami warning. So it did startle me at first, but I guess since I've heard these alarms a few times from these earthquake warnings that happen more often than these tsunami earthquakes, I decided to just keep my calm. And then I went downstairs to find my father and then turned on the news. And it said that we were in an area that needed to evacuate. So we called my mom, who was grocery shopping, I think. We called her home and then we decided to evacuate to a higher ground.
So I'm curious, how close is your home to the sea?
So it's about a 5-minute walk to the beach.
You're pretty close to sea level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you spoke with your mom. She was shopping. Once she got home, where did you evacuate to? Like, where is the nearest high ground?
Since we live 5 minutes away from the beach, we were a little bit worried that if the tsunami did come, that we would be affected by it. So we decided to go to my university, which is about 30 minutes away by car.
So how long, Moe, did you stay kind of in evacuation mode? And what were you feeling as you were waiting?
At around 10 or 11, they said that the tsunami would hit around 11.
11 a.m. local time.
11 a.m., yes. I don't know if it actually hit. Maybe if it did, then it was around 30 centimeters. I didn't see a high number.
Yeah, that's about a foot or so.
Yes, exactly. But they kept saying on the news that there could be like second waves, third waves that could come later in the day. So we decided it would be safe if we stayed in an area that was at least 30 minutes drive away from the beach. So we decided to spend the whole day there. So my parents, they went to a local shopping mall, whereas I stayed in the school and I did some schoolwork there.
So I'm guessing the vulnerability of your area to tsunamis is dependent on where the epicenter of the earthquake is. But generally, has your area witnessed many tsunamis?
Not that I'm aware of. There was one big earthquake that happened back in 2011. It was the Great Eastern Japan earthquake.
Right, the Tohoku.
Yeah, the one you were talking about a bit earlier on, yes.
I mean, you're 22, as I said, which means you were 7 or 8 when the devastating magnitude 9 quake hit Tohoku and led to the meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant.
Right.
Given that experience, what significance do tsunami warnings carry today in Japan?
Well, that's a good question. I experienced the tsunami in 2011 when I was, I think, 8 years old. And back then, it was the first time I experienced a really big earthquake. It kind of became not a slightly traumatic experience, but I remember whenever I hear the sound of the alarms that I would get very scared. So I think we take the warnings more seriously because of the experience that we have from 2011. And we have this mentality that it's better to be safe than sorry. So a lot of families have these evacuation bags prepared at home so that whenever there is a warning that we can just take that. And in many households, we decide where we would evacuate to if there was a warning like this.
Yeah, I mean, that mantra, better safe than sorry. What kind of emergency training do you get?
So in school, we get these earthquake drills. We would go through this drill of what we would do if there was a big earthquake that hit. So we would wear these helmets and then we would dive under the table and then we would evacuate to the grounds. And then our parents would pick us up.
All the way through the parents coming to collect you at school. That's part of the drill.
Exactly, exactly.
I'm curious, does the Japanese government urge people to prepare go bags, you know, have a kind of box or a bag?
Oh, definitely. I don't know if it's the government or just the media, but there are a lot of people on the news saying that we should be prepared for another big earthquake within the next 30 years or so. So I think a lot of people are trying to prepare for that as well.
I wanted to ask you about those kind of future concerns because tsunamis, obviously the result of earthquakes, and you've mentioned that between the two, it's earthquakes that are most feared in Japan, despite the massive flooding and trauma of 2011. What did the earthquake and the warnings of the last 24 hours bring up for people in Japan?
I don't know. I guess it gave us a, I don't want to say it's a heads up because there actually was a area that was affected by these earthquakes outside of Japan and things like that. But it did really open our eyes up again about the disasters that could happen within the next few years, I guess.
Moe Miyake joined us from Chigasaki, Japan. And now let's catch you up on a few more headlines in today's news.
The Taiwanese government has called off a plan for its president to visit the U.S. on his way to Latin America. It is not exactly clear why. The Associated Press says conflicting reasons are being given about who proposed the visit and who decided to cancel it. China views Taiwan as a breakaway province, and the government in Beijing doesn't like it when U.S. officials meet with leaders from the island. State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce said the next meeting had been hypothetical and never really planned.
It is slow going for European economic growth. In the quarter that just ended, growth was just 0.1% over the previous quarter. For the 20 countries that use the euro currency, the economic forecast in the months ahead is not great, given the new 15% tariff imposed on European goods sold here in the U.S.
And YouTube is social media, according to the Australian government, at least. The video sharing platform was included in rules announced today related to a new law that prohibits kids under 16 from having social media accounts. It's putting YouTube in the same bucket as Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. YouTube says it is not social media, and the company is considering next steps. The age restrictions take effect December 10th.
Follow more global news online. We are at theworld.org.
Wildfires are a growing problem in many parts of the globe due to climate change. We're going to visit a couple of those places now, starting in the Mediterranean. Firefighters are battling blazes in Greece and Bulgaria. More than 34,000 acres have burned in Portugal. And in Spain, fires are spreading just an hour from Madrid. But this year, the country with the highest death toll is Turkey, where 17 people, mostly first responders, have died in fires since June. The World's Joy Buscarin reports from western Turkey near the city of Bursa.
This fire just missed Karahadir village. It blackened the trees on the hillside, all the way down to the edge of the tidy pink and white apartment blocks. Today was the day for the town's uncles to gather at the tea house under the big oak trees and figure out what to do next. There were no lives lost in our village, says Husmetin Akgul, but on the mountains, in the forests. The animals made such a sound, he says, breaking off in tears. Akgul is 69. He was born in this village, grew up herding sheep and hunting mushrooms in the forest. He's never known a time when wildfires were a risk here. The area is known for its fruit trees, thanks to ample rainfall. But the climate here is changing. We've had droughts before, really high temperatures, he says, but never a fire. The fires in the villages on the outskirts of Turkey's fourth largest city, Bursa, are among hundreds of blazes that have swept the countryside this summer. The Turkish government has blamed arson for many of the fires, detaining 168 people since the 1st of June. Meanwhile, residents described chaotic scenes, trying to fight the flames themselves before firefighting teams could arrive. Residents of Narlıdere village described the challenges the firefighters faced when they arrived. Steep, unpaved roads, no place to refuel their water trucks. It was a coordination problem, says İsmail Sonju. It's a lack of coordination with the forest ministry, with the state. While locals made use of farm equipment, teams came in from faraway cities to help. Three volunteer firefighters from out of town died when their truck overturned on the mountain. It happened right over there, says Saadettin Uysal, shaking his head sadly. Occasional wildfires in the Mediterranean basin are normal, says Boğaziçi University climate scientist Levent Kurnaz.
But the forest fires at the moment are about 30 times more frequent and more intense.
Kurnaz says more carbon in the atmosphere pushes temperatures higher, drying out the trees and underbrush. It makes rain come less often or unpredictably.
In Istanbul, it hasn't rained a drop for the past 2 months.
And so it only takes a few sparks from an outdoor stove or the butt of a cigarette to set off a massive blaze, says Kurnaz.
They always think that is somebody else's fault. And we have to teach people that these forest fires are exact results of their actions.
In other words, fires can be started by accident, by just about anybody. He says places that aren't used to having wildfires, they need to prepare for them. The fires are out for now in the villages near Bursa, but teams of firefighters have stayed in place, keeping watch. Even after a fire has been put out, embers can smolder undetected. As I took a photo of a hillside near the village of Alışan, I noticed a stream of smoke starting to emerge from the pine trees, some 50 yards down the hill.
Arkadaşlar, biraz duman var. O kontrol mu?
I asked a pair of volunteers nearby if it was a controlled burn. They checked. It was not. Three women watch from the roof of their home as flames quickly appear and devour an old pine tree on the edge of the village. Firefighters rush to douse the fire with a water truck, but it's clear that their work is far from over. For The World, I'm Derya Buscarin, Bursa, Turkey.
The work of putting out a wildfire is just the first step in keeping a forest protected.
Historically, after a wildfire tore through a forest, it would leave a trail of burned trees and charred soil. Over time, the land would recover and become fertile again. But now there's not always enough time between fires for that to happen.
In British Columbia, indigenous communities are leaning into solutions. Angela Kane is the CEO of the Secwepemc Restoration and Stewardship Society. The group was founded after a megafire in 2017. We spoke recently, and she explained what's needed for recovery after fires like that.
It's hard to explain unless you've actually seen after a wildfire, but there's nothing left. Mm. Like it is just a desolate area that you've just got trees that there's no green whatsoever. They're charred. There's black. So there's nothing there to actually help regen because the ground is just so hard and so impacted.
So before we hear about the indigenous interventions in wildfire recovery that your organization is doing, can you tell us what recovery efforts look like that don't include those practices?
Typically, what will happen is the provincial government will go out and assess the damage and what areas need to be replanted. There's also opportunity where timber harvesters will go in and harvest the area if there's salvageable timber. Unfortunately, the species that the provincial government and the timber harvesters put back, they're putting back for more economic purposes and not so much for a healthy ecosystem.
So they're planting so that trees can be harvested again in 10, 20 years as a cash crop, basically.
Exactly.
Okay. So now can we talk about what you are doing, what your organization is doing, and how it's different?
Well, we're different because we're connecting with the local communities that have been impacted by the fire and understanding from them, their perspective, what areas they would like to see replanted. Because typically, We used to have a lot more grasslands and meadows within our forests, but with over-harvesting and replanting, we're seeing that those areas are being encroached on by those trees. What we then in turn do is sit down, like I said, and chat with the communities, identify areas for regeneration. We'll also then ask them what type of species that they would like to see back onto the land. So that's what we're looking at doing, connecting with the communities, understanding what the land was like prior to the fire or prior to the mismanagement, and incorporating that into our restoration processes.
So you're not trying to return these landscapes to what they were immediately prior to the fire. Are you trying to return to a date earlier in history, like before colonization, or are you not returning to a specific time at all?
Yeah, I don't think we can ever go back. You know, when we've got climate change happening and we've got different factors and impacts on land and the environment, I think we have to look at what is the healthiest way to put the land back.
What do you mean by the healthiest? How do you define that?
Well, healthiest is a healthy ecosystem is when you have a combination of a mix of species. So we're looking at our coniferous, which are the Douglas fir and the spruce, and then we're looking at our deciduous, which are aspen, cottonwoods, and willows, which is typically how a natural forest should go, is you have that combination of different trees and your understory, which includes the cultural plants, which are foods like wild strawberries and wild onions and potatoes. There's also the medicinal plants.
So give me a sense of scale here. The 2017 fires burnt something like 750 square miles of land. How much has your group been able to restore?
Oh, gosh, not even close to that. It takes that takes a long time. We've been able to probably plant about 3,000 hectares is about it. Yeah.
So that's about a dozen square miles.
Yeah.
So it's a small piece of the solution here. Are you thinking of how you are making these pieces of land more resilient to future fires? Is that part of the calculation on how to make them healthy?
Yeah, I mean, we've been able to determine that typically in a natural forest landscape, aspen and cottonwoods hold a lot of water and moisture around them, and they actually are a fire break. It helps the fire slow down within that area. So having that mixture of your deciduous and your coniferous helps mitigate the fires, slows them down.
This is labor-intensive work, and it is not fast. As you said, it's taken, what, 5 years to replant some dozen square miles of forest land when 750 square miles were burned in one fire back in 2017. I'm wondering, you know, what else needs to happen big picture in British Columbia to protect forests as climate change accelerates?
I think the biggest thing that needs to happen is looking at working together to determine areas for, you know, fire mitigation, whether it's fuel management around communities to help with that. It's looking at what constitutes a healthy ecosystem from both forestry and First Nations perspectives and working together to build that.
Angela Kane, CEO of the Sequet Mukuluk Restoration and Stewardship Society in British Columbia, Canada.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Creams and other products that lighten the color of your skin can be found in cosmetics aisles all over the world. Ads like these play from Asia to Africa.
White Secret Beauty Cream. Get notice now.
Light, shine, and beautiful. Beautiful on your body. Okay? So follow the tricks that I just show you right now.
This despite the fact that we've known for a long time that skin lightening creams are bad for your health. They've even been linked to cancer. In South Africa, Dr. Noza Dlova is trying to raise awareness of that risk. She's the head of dermatology at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, where she's conducting a study of more than 55 cases in sub-Saharan countries linking these products to skin cancer. We spoke earlier today.
This is a very scary observation. Myself and Professor Fatima Lee from Senegal, a dermatologist, we've busy writing up a paper where there's 50 patients, women, who developed a squamous cell carcinoma over a period of about 20 years of using the skin bleaching creams that contain either hydroquinone, mercury, and some skin corticosteroids. So it's quite frightening. That's why now we feel, you know, we really have to do something about this, because in the past we're seeing you know, thinning of the skin, permanent stretch marks, infections, as well as steroid-induced acne, etc. But now, with the resurgence of squamous cell carcinoma, it's really raising red flags that we really have to do something as health workers.
So carcinomas, this is the same kind of cancer one might get from overexposure to the sun, correct?
Absolutely, because as you can imagine, when you use skin bleaching creams, you're actually removing the very same pigment that's supposed to protect your skin from the damage from ultraviolet rays. And a darker skin patient, they've got an average of about 15 SPF in terms of UVB protection without even using a sunscreen. So now if you remove that melanin, you're actually exposing the skin to more damaging ultraviolet rays.
So hydroquinone, that is a product and then found in a lot of these skin lightening creams. I thought that had been banned by a lot of countries.
That is true. For example, in South Africa, 50 years ago, South Africa was one of the first countries to ban over-the-counter sale of hydroquinone. So the measures were kind of strict. The government was abiding by that. But then with time, all of that changed, and now we're seeing a resurgence of skin bleaching creams again in the last maybe 10, 15 years. And what's interesting now is that it's not just hydroquinone. They're also using compounds with mercury as well as compounds with corticosteroids, which are easily available and cheaper and affordable for the low socioeconomic groups.
Yeah, so is there a black market for banned skin lightening products at this point?
There is. Some of the products come in illegally through our porous borders. And also in terms of regulation, you know, the regulation is not that strict.
So as far as your research, doctor, into the link between skin lightening creams and cancer, how strong is the evidence for that link at the moment?
My colleague, Professor Fatima Lee from Senegal, she's been collecting these cases. And I think the first case was reported in Ghana in 2000. And then there was another one reported in Togo and in the Ivory Coast. To date, she's collected about 50 patients of squamous cell carcinoma on the neck and face and sometimes at the back. And all these patients give a history of using skin lightening creams, whether it's a hydroquinone-containing mercury as well as a topical steroids for almost, you know, average between 15 and 20 years. You know, if one looks at the textbooks in dermatology, there are a few circumstances where black patients get skin cancer. Now, I think the new kid on the block is actually the use of skin lightening creams causing or being linked to squamous cell carcinoma.
Skin lightening products used to only be affordable by people with higher incomes, but has that changed? Like, how widespread are they used today on the continent?
These are easily available from street vendors, sometimes from hair salons, and sometimes from the markets. Now they are marketing them, you know, to young children as well, so which is really scary. It's a socio-political, psychological phenomenon. It's about colonialism. It's about the fact that people feel that when they are lighter, they are more attractive, there are more possibilities of getting jobs and more possibilities of getting married. Then there's media as well, the social media, use of models and celebrities who are lighter in complexion. So there's a whole concoction and complex issue that needs to be addressed.
There are also influencers online, it seems, who are very pro-skin lightening cream, and they're saying these products are safe. Just be careful using them, mix them with other stuff, shea butter. What kind of effect are influencers having on this market?
Absolutely. I'm glad you asked that question. The influencers also contribute a lot, you know, to the trend to use skin bleaching creams because the celebrities use safer products. There are safer products that can be used to treat disorders of hyperpigmentation. But the low-income group cannot afford those expensive products because they are beyond their financial reach. So they tend to use products that are not backed by science and they are mixed with other things. So it's a challenge.
When your research with Dr. Lee in Senegal is complete, what do you hope your findings lead to?
So another very crucial element of what we need to do as dermatologists is education. Empower the consumers with information, education, and complications, because at least a patient that is informed and empowered with knowledge, then at least they know that if they use these products, then they're going to have problems. Only yesterday I saw a patient who had skin damage or chronosis on the face and neck, middle-aged woman, about 45 or 50. Mm. And when I told her that, you know what, I'm sorry, there's not much I can do because your skin is damaged, irreversible. So, and she started crying, you know, because she didn't know. So I asked her, how did you get to use this product? And I saw my friend looking lighter and prettier. So I said, what's your definition of prettier? Oh, she was bright and smooth and lighter. So we have to change all these concepts and perceived ideas that when you're lighter, you are, you know, you're actually more attractive. And I think also if we target schools, you know, we start from a younger age, from primary schools, and say, you know, the best skin that you have is the one that you're born with.
Dr. Nosedlova is the head of dermatology at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. She's been researching the cancer risks of skin lightening creams that are popular around the globe.
Earlier this hour, we were talking fire. Tomorrow on the show, rain, monsoon rains. They're part of the rhythm of life in South Asia, but climate change is making monsoon rains less predictable and more dangerous. Be with us tomorrow for reporting from India about how people are coping with the changes.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Steve Henn, Dan Shi and Ted McGovern, Sharon G. and Robert L. Ryan, and Frederica and Howard Stevenson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.